Macro Trading Floor.
With me, Alfonso Peccatiello, founder of the Macro Compass and former head of investments at a large European bank.
And I am Brent Donnelly, president of Spectrum Markets. I've been a portfolio manager, day trader, and market maker at the biggest commercial and investment banks in the United States. I'm also the author of Alpha Trader and The Art of Currency Trading. If you want to know what's going on in markets and where they're going, you found the right podcast.
Hey everyone, this is Alf speaking. Welcome back on the Macro Trading Floor. Macro volatility is brewing under the surface. Nominal growth remains good, but the Fed is still talking about cuts. And so markets are starting to react accordingly. It started with gold and oil rallying a couple of weeks ago, but it's now zinc, silver, copper, any commodities. This is happening because the Fed is willing to come in and cut rates despite the economy still holding up, and investors are reaching out for assets that can serve as a hedge against the reflation that will be fueled by unnecessary Fed cuts. I told you that macro vol will dominate the next decade, and this is why, before we go ahead with the show this week, I want you to stop doing what you're doing and listen up, because I have a big announcement. It's time to be back in the game. I am launching my macro hedge fund. The fund will trade global macro strategies, taking advantage of the upcoming decade of macro vol and the abundant opportunities popping up around the world in many asset classes. The fund targets double-digit returns on average per year. It has already raised more than $50 million of early interest from investors, and if you come in early, you will have two main benefits: a preferential fee terms locked in forever, and free access to my macro research to help you make sense of markets all year round. If you're interested to read the fund memo and consider a potential allocation taking advantage of this exclusive early investor window, you should send me an email at fund@themacrocompass.com. So if you're interested in my macro fund, stop what you're doing and send that email now before you forget. I will reply personally and answer all your questions. fund@themacrocompass.com. The email is also mentioned in the show notes. Finally, to remember, the minimum allocation for regulatory reasons is $250,000. And now, back to the show for this week. So as promised, we're here. Brent, how are you doing?
Hey, Alf, I'm great. Looks like a tiny bit of sunshine outside today, so I guess we made it through winter.
Yeah, well, I need to move back to the south of Italy, man. I'm very depressed over here in the Netherlands. But next week I'm going back. Pizza, mozzarella, all this nice stuff waiting for me. Looking forward. Okay, enough with the food and weather. So there is one common narrative in markets that I see emerging. So I wanted your opinion on that, which is that basically we have central banks still somehow committed to a cutting cycle, maybe less intense than before, but still committed to cutting. But we have nominal growth doing fine, and we have the markets behaving accordingly, I would say. But what's your thought on the overall market price action over the last week?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. I would say that the US ISM manufacturing felt like a bit of a catalyst, where there's this nascent rebound happening in manufacturing globally. And I think people have been highlighting it for a while, but it's just been so slow paced that it's been a little bit hard to get excited about it. And then this week, everything just got released to the top side. So it looks like full blown global reflation trade. And the thing is, though, usually when you have a reflation trade, that's a part of the cycle where you're still concerned about rate hikes. So that's kind of like something that pulls back the reins a little bit on the reflation trade, is that say you get a strong data point like ISM manufacturing in a hiking cycle, then that could actually be kind of bad news for the reflation trade, because it signals that the Fed or whoever is going to hike more. But since hikes are not part of the distribution really right now in the mind of most people, it's a really interesting setup, because you have inflation above target in the US, nominal growth is strong, and commodities are ripping, and no risk of rate hikes. In fact, all you're doing is recalibrating the risk of rate cuts, and the cuts are pretty much priced similar to the dots now. So it's a very interesting and somewhat inflationary setup in my mind.
Yeah, I think that what the market is doing here is the following. They're looking at economists' forecast for US GDP growth at over 2% real by the end of the year. They're looking at core inflation, which is annualizing at 2.5%. So they're saying 2 real plus 2.5% core inflation. It's 4.5% nominal growth, quite respectable. And then they're looking at central banks saying, yeah, 4.5% nominal growth. I'm still going to cut rates. And then the market's like, okay, so what are we going to do there? Well, if you're a commodity proactively, let's call them insurance cuts or proactive cuts or whatever you want to call them, while you're having a temporary reflation in terms of cycle, right? Then what you do as an investor is you lift all assets you can. I mean, cash is really not the best option right there because the economy is doing okay and the central bank is willing to proactively ease. So what happens is you go and buy all assets you can, right? And in particular, all risk assets you can. And if we want to zoom in again, you're going to probably be doing stuff that does well if nominal growth is doing well. So then commodities are a good candidate for that kind of reflation trade, right? And we discussed offline, and I want to put through the idea and compare these notes with you. That this looks a little bit, with differences as well, but a little bit like the second half of 2007. And I'm going to set up the idea here. So please back me up or tell me I'm wrong, but let's discuss this. So in 2005 and 6, the Federal Reserve had raised interest rates pretty aggressively, up until 5%, I think, 5% Fed funds. So pretty much where we are today, okay? And then in the summer of 2006, they stopped. And they paused for 15 months of 5% plus Fed funds. And then they started cutting rates in September 2007. Now, in the second half of 2007, when they started cutting interest rates, there was no great financial crisis yet at all. Actually, what it was out there is that core inflation was annualizing 3% in the second half of 2007, and the labor market was slow, but not recessionary. And the Fed cut rates. And the market did something fun. So oil, I think, went up like 50% in 6 months, and wheat was up 60%, and commodities and gold and everything rallied. And it looks a little bit like that to me, but I'm going to shut up for a second and tell me how wrong am I?
No, I agree that it's a very similar feeling, but the big difference is that in that case, you had so much leverage in the system that that inflationary bang eventually led to obviously a deflationary bust. But in this case, it doesn't really feel to me as much like the conditions are there for the deflationary bust after. Like, sure, we had Silvergate and all that stuff. So there is some fragility in the system, you could argue. But there's just so much less leverage that it makes me wonder if we do embark on that. And to me, it feels like we're on the front edge of something like that, of a commodity reflationary boom. If we're on the front edge of that and that accelerates, then where does that lead? Because in the end, it led to rate cuts in 07, which eventually were ratified by the global financial crisis. But in this case, if you don't have as much leverage, then where does that lead? Does it lead to Fed hikes eventually in 2020 at the end of the year? I mean, that's not even on the bingo card still. They're still talking about cuts. So you'd probably have to go through first a very reflationary cycle where they do cut, or they don't cut, but the cuts just stay on the 3 to 4 months out, like they've been since Waller kind of teed them up last November. But all of this to me is very reflationary. And then another interesting thing that's kind of going on in the background is that the reflation has generally been very US led. So there's been this US exceptionalism going on. But if you look at the last month and you look at, say, equity indices over the last month, Dow's flat, NASDAQ flat, Canada's up 3%, Euro stocks up 3%, IBEX up 10%. Basically, Europe is up a lot and the rest of the world is flat. So that's more of a traditional manufacturing-led, China-led type of equity performance. And I think that's super interesting. So I put out a bearish dollar note on Monday or Tuesday this week. Because I feel like, and we've talked about this a few times in the podcast, that it's very hard to find the middle of the dollar smile these days where US is not exceptional. But I feel like right now we're actually in that. We're in a period where the market's long dollars. So positioning is quite long dollars. The seasonality is bad for the dollar. Generally, the dollar sells off in April. The techs are pretty good to be short dollars. And then we had yields go higher this week, and the dollar couldn't rally on that. So I feel like the price action there is quite bearish dollars as well. So maybe the mindset can be a more traditional middle of the dollar smile, which is exactly where we were in 2007, where commodities rally, Europe outperforms, and the dollar sells off. That's kind of where I am at right now.
Yeah, I think the missing link to 2007 is clearly either the dollar weakening because global growth is strong, which was the case in 2007. Emerging markets and Europe were dominating, actually, the US, or that the higher for longer stance, which gets prolonged months after months after months after months, ends up breaking something. Okay. And in the end of 2007, it was financials. Banks. You started getting the first cracks there. I think the bank index was down 25% between June and December 07. Okay, so the cracks were appearing, high yield spreads were widening. Today, we have nothing out of that, nothing at all. So as you say, there is less leverage in the system. There's a lot more regulation. The US private sector has worked its way to be more resilient to higher interest rates, I would say. So if we discard the option that something is going to break in the US necessarily, then the dollar weakening can come only if global growth is strong. So if we have a proper typical reflation trade, right, Brent, where you have as well global growth, not only US idiosyncratic growth. And we haven't really seen that so far, but if the manufacturing cycle is turning, then yeah, you can make a case that this is going to broaden out. In my opinion, the funny thing of them all is that other central banks right now are starting to be priced more dovishly than the Fed. And the market has looked for this theme for like months and months and months. There was some point late last year where the UK and Europe were priced, hear me, to be more hawkish than the Federal Reserve. And I was looking at this stuff, like, you know what? And now the market finally has moved to the point where they say, no, the ECB will actually cut more than the Fed, okay? And the Bank of England will start cutting more. But is it not funny that if we get a global reflation type of trade, actually, this might not be the case? I don't know, but I'm just throwing hypotheses out there to make it similar to 2007 in a way or another, because 2007, the Fed cut rates 100 basis points between September and December 07. And do you want to guess what the ECB did between September and December 07? Nothing. They did nothing. And then in 08, I think they even hiked. I mean, geez. So things can get very funky out there.
Yeah, that's a very famous hike when they hiked in July 2008, right before the crisis. Very infamous, I guess, not famous. The thing that's interesting to me is that, I mean, you've had this chart in your pieces quite a lot of the rising expectations for US GDP. So we've gone all the way from whatever it was, 0 to 3 or something like that in terms of expectations for GDP. And then in your chart, you show all the other countries are still in the toilet in terms of expectations.
Yes.
But I think that's actually could potentially be an interesting setup because the starting point has been so much towards assuming that the US is the best, that even if you get a moderate sort of credit cycle revival in Europe, which some of the charts are kind of starting to show, maybe like a little bit of Phoenix rising from the ashes in Europe, then the starting point is so extreme that even if the US does okay, if Europe and China just do a little bit better, then that can contribute actually to this global growth. Because the big problem with commodities has been up until very recently, has been that you just can't run the whole world on one with one engine, which was the US. Like Europe was sucking wind, China was sucking wind. And so if you go to a world where Europe's kind of okay, which like you said, I don't know if there's that much evidence of it other than the equity performance potentially being a leading indicator, which it could be. And then with China, I guess it's always going to be the battle between the balance sheet recession, the structural stuff is going to be horrendous forever or for a long time. But then you can still have little cycles inside that, right? Like little kind of slightly better cycles inside that. And maybe, again, looking at not at the Chinese economic data because it's very difficult to parse, but just looking at commodities, maybe there is some kind of green shoots type of thing happening there where and that's driving oil and copper and all that. And then one other interesting thing kind of under the hood, because if you look at commodities, it doesn't matter if you're long cocoa or gold, like whatever, everything's just going up. But if you look under the hood, one thing that's really interesting to me on the commodity side is that silver's ripping now. So that's been a missing piece for me, because the gold trade has essentially been about central banks, right? Yeah. If you look at a chart of like the gold ETF holdings, which is more retail, that thing's been going straight down as gold has been going straight up. So that implies central bank activity is the dominant flow, and retail has been not doing that, probably buying Bitcoin instead of gold, given the ETF launch there. And normally silver is a lot more retail, and in a debasement trade, usually silver is more volatile and more exciting, but it's been doing nothing up until recently. But now it's just gone from 24 to 27. And I think that's interesting, because that shows that maybe retail's finally maybe got enough Bitcoin. That's not bearish Bitcoin, but it might mean that the switcheroo from precious into Bitcoin could be done. And then that leaves now some retail people saying, oh, maybe I'm a little bit underweight precious metals. And you could get another wave of gold and silver buying that comes from retail, because retail's been asleep on this move.
Yeah, very interesting discussion on commodities, where basically the fuel to propel the move higher in commodities in 2007 also came from a weaker dollar across the board. And if that happens this time as well, maybe based as well on some global reflationary thesis, the moves we have seen over the last week in commodity space, the most interesting part is that before it used to be like, you know, gold is rallying, oil is rallying, sure, and that's it. And now you get this week, I'm looking at volatility adjusted moves. Huh? Silver is out, is up over 2 standard deviations. Platinum is up 1 standard deviation. Copper is up 2 standard deviations. Nickel, zinc, they're up 2 standard deviations. I mean, those are like a broad variety of metals, industrial, precious, anything actually in the commodity space that is metal, both cyclical and precious, is up. So it looks to be broadening, I think. And yeah, a weaker dollar across the board, I think, would be the last thing that propels this higher. But then my real question is, what's the bond market doing here? I mean, if this is a reflation trade, Brent, let's assume this is a full-fledged reflation trade. What this means is that nominal growth is marching higher, maybe globally, not only US-driven. And the Federal Reserve doesn't want to hear it, Brent. They're still going to cut. You know, it's going to be cuts. They're going to do 2 or 3 or whatever. But they're not going to react historically, as historically they would do with a reflation. They're not going to hike. At best, they're going to delay the cut, but they're still going to cut in a reflation. Now, from what I understand out of bond markets, might not be the biggest expert on the planet, but I know a thing or two. If that happens, it's a recipe for a steepening, right? It should steepen the curve pretty aggressively, because the front end is, well, kind of pinned by the Federal Reserve proactively dovish stance, but the long end can express instead the term premium, the uncertainty about what the cuts are going to be doing to further putting fuel on the fire of the reflation down the road. And so generally investors will, you know, steepen out the curve, and they will want more premium to own these long end bonds. And it isn't really happening yet. So can it be that, you know, the curve has to steepen aggressively? In 2007, it steepened like hell, but because the Fed came in and did emergency cut. So can we get some sort of steepening this time? I think this will be the dollar weakening, the commodity broadening, and the steepening. I think then we're full in 2007.
I think for the bond market, you need this to go on for a little bit longer, because you're entering this period of, like, let's say copper started ripping in March. So that's still like early March. So that's still only really a month and a bit of this. But coming into that, you were witnessing broad disinflationary forces, like look at Swiss CPI and Canadian CPI and all that. So I think in the face of these global disinflationary winds, now we've got like a big reflationary crosswind. But I think net 1 month of that isn't quite enough to scare the bond market. But I think each month that goes by where you get continued inflation in commodities and continued message from the Fed that rate hikes are not a thing. Because like that, I think, is an interesting part of the setup here, is that the distribution is completely capped. There's nothing. I mean, sure, I'm sure some people are buying some wingy options on hikes, but generally, I don't think anyone really believes that another round of rate hikes is coming. So I think each month that goes by that we continue with this, then eventually we're going to get pressure on the bond market, because the disinflationary forces of that we were getting from goods, especially, but just in general, inflation was just had a lot of downward momentum, especially outside the US. You can argue the US, depending on what number you look at, you can say services are sticky and it's high, or you can look at, you know, 3 month annualized of goods and whatever, but the US is a little bit harder to read, but I think globally inflation has been coming down a lot. And so, you know, 30 days of reflation isn't going to scare the bond market because it could just be, you know, a small wave. But I think if this continues, say, through the summer, then I think then you're going to probably get bond market a little bit unhinged, steepening, and then you'll probably see an acceleration in bond market volatility because, yeah, a lot of the drop in bond market volatility has been because Fed expectations are so narrow, like the cone of uncertainty around Fed policy is pretty narrow. But regardless of that, at some point, this will turn into a Fed policy error kind of trade like 07, where they kind of lose the handle on commodities and commodities start going nuts and people start doing protection trades. And then, I mean, then probably you get, I guess, a bear steepening.
Yeah, or a bull steepening or any sort. I mean, in 2007, the banks broke. So the Fed had to come in and do something as a repair type of cuts while commodities were ripping and the curve bull steepened. You can as well get a bear steepening. Yeah? But the idea is indeed that to get the curve to steepen here, you need some macro vol, you need some resolution of this type of convergence in macro, which has been boring for 3 months. But now I think it's starting to pick up. I mean, it can get quite interesting. And talking about stuff getting interesting, I still am trying to figure out what our friends in Japan have in mind. So we always end up talking about Japan every week just because it's fun, you know. These guys are in Japan, they're doing their own stuff. I can imagine them sitting on the Bloomberg screens and looking at dollar JPY and saying, oh, it's 152. What do we do, friends? Is this 10 points away natural disaster intervention area? Shall we stop people out or shall we let them have fun with their long dollar JPY? And everybody's looking at this thing, but you're the expert, so please tell us.
Well, so I will say, I think the MOF, the Ministry of Finance, has a lot of credibility. Generally, they've been pretty good. Like they were buying in the 75, 78. They were selling at 152. It, you know, they've had other incidents over the years where they've generally been pretty good, not perfect. Nobody's perfect, but they've been pretty good. So I think they're smart enough to know that you can't set a line in the sand. Like that was one mistake of many mistakes that the Swiss National Bank made, is that if you tell everyone, hey, we're going to defend this level, then it just makes it a target. You put a target on your back because then people go, oh yeah, okay, well, let's see. So what I think they'll have to do is let it go up through 152, up to say 154, 155. Make it look like they're not around and then crush the market again. So that's kind of my base case. One thing about this 152 level is, I mean, I've been trading dollar yen, man, for a long time, 25 years, I guess. And every now and then you get a level like this where everybody is watching it. But the more important thing is that everybody knows that everybody knows that everybody's watching it. So everyone has like this double layer of excitement and then convexity as well, because in the real world, people leave their orders. So if you want to sell dollars, you're going to sell them ahead of 152. And if you're going to stop out, you're going to stop out above 152. So what it ends up creating is this massive pocket of essentially long gamma ahead of it and then short gamma behind it. So in other words, a lot of dollars to sell, infinity dollars to sell. And then if it breaks, infinity dollars to buy. And there's two other times that this setup happened that I can remember really clearly during Abenomics, because human beings love round numbers. On the way up, 100 was a really big level because we had just come from 75.0 to 100.0 in a straight line. And it was the exact same thing. It was bouncing off. Everyone was talking about it. And then when it went through, it just was an absolute laser. Like it exploded up through and it looked back eventually, but initially it absolutely ripped. Like everyone that was short got caught. And it feels very, very similar to me. So to me, it's a perfect setup for the MOF to let it go, let all the shorts cover, because what you don't want to be doing is intervening into a market that where there's a lot of shorts, because then there's a lot of buyers of dollars. So if they let it go to 154, then intervene, they'll probably find a pretty good air pocket. So that's my base case. I feel like playing it becomes very tactical and very cat and mouse. And you can't look at it as a carry trade or as a dollar trade. You just have to look at it when it's this. I mean, right now it's 34 pips away from 152. You have to just look at it as a game theory,
yeah.
Ministry of Finance, what are they going to do trade? And if you want to trade a dollar view, you shouldn't be trading dollar yen right now because there's too much idiosyncratic risk. I mean, when they intervened last couple of times, it went down about 500 points. So even if you don't think they're going to intervene, if you're wrong, it's going to be very expensive.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to add something on top of it, but when it comes to, Japan, it's very hard to read their mind. And, if the dollar weakens at a broader level, then it should also weaken against the yen. But there are other idiosyncratic situations here, like interest rate differentials. It's something that I've been just watching against the dollar and say, I'm going to do nothing. I've been short the long the yen, but versus the Swiss franc. But that's a different type of trade. But dollar JPY, it's oof. I leave this to the smart guys like you, man, in FX. It's not something for me. I'm a boring medium-term macro trader. And I don't know if these guys in Japan wake up tomorrow and hit anything on the screen. I don't want to be caught in the crossroads of that if I can. Talking about this, any trade ideas for the week?
So, like I said, I mean, it's a little bit stale because it's been a few days, but I'm bearish dollar. Like I put out a piece on Monday or Tuesday explaining it. And if I go through my whole framework of like seasonality, technicals, price action, macro, cross market correlation, every single thing, like if I go down my checklist, to me, everything points to lower dollar. Mm-hmm. And this is all contingent, obviously, on this reflation trade and this flow of funds trade continuing. By flow of funds, I mean all the money's now not going to the US. Like the acronym was TINA, which is there is no alternative. And we kind of oscillate between once in a while there is an alternative. And obviously, given the performance of European equities, people have felt like there is an alternative. And if we're on the front edge of a reflation cycle and a manufacturing rebound, which it does seem like we are to me, then that's quite dollar negative. So even though this initial view, sometimes I'll start with a tactical view where like the technicals are really good. So, you only have to risk 50 basis points to make 100. But then when you're 100 basis points in the money, if things have changed a little bit more, like a watershed kind of change, which would start with a weak payrolls, I guess, although this podcast will come out after that or around the same time as that. So for now, it's a tactical trade, short dollars across the board. I like Canada, Australia. I mean, I like Europe. I like Norway. But it will be a little bit contingent on where we go from here in terms of the reflation trade. But my view for now is that this reflation trade continues because the standard monetary policy pushback is just not even a lever that's even close to being pulled at this point.
Yeah. And so weak dollar trade. Interesting, I would say at this point, still non-consensus, which is always good when you put up a trade. Doesn't mean that non-consensus will be right, which is something I hear all the time. Oh, I have to be outside consensus. Well, it's better, let's say, if you can make a story by which your trade isn't crowded, but crowded trades can become more crowded, by the way. So it's not like some people want sort of a badge of honor if they're, non-consensus. But there is no badge of honor. It's a different payoff structure if you're non-consensus, let's say, than if you are consensus.
I agree with that, actually. Very good traders can go with the trend or go against it, and they don't really have a strong preference. I feel like people that are always contrarian, they're trying more to be smart and catch the top tick than to make money. And that's not the correct incentive structure. You should be trying to make money, not be smart.
Yeah. There are probably more trends out there happening than people catching the tops or the bottoms, let's say.
That's the thing, is that markets trend, and sometimes the easiest money is to just ride the trend.
Or as my mentor used to say, if you try to catch the bottom, you get smelly fingers. But okay, that's another very weird thing that my mentor used to say. Now, coming to the trade ideas, I personally like steepeners here in the yield curve, which, again, It's very easy to say because they're negative carry. So if you own steepeners, it's expensive to own. Although 530s in the US cost you about 2 basis points a month in negative carry and roll. 2 basis points, it's not a ridiculous amount. You can pay them, I think. It's acceptable. And the steepeners brand, I think, here can work in a few scenarios. So they can work if data deteriorates all of a sudden. So we're releasing the podcast right before the non-farm payrolls. I have no idea what the non-farm payrolls will be, but let's assume they're weak. Yes, guess what? The Fed will be priced to come in with more cuts and the curve will probably steepen. If non-farm payrolls are very strong, there will be another confirmation that the reflation is broadening. And if the Fed keeps talking about cuts while the reflation is broadening, then you're going to get a steeper curve as well. So basically, my story on steepeners here is I expect some macro vol to pop up anytime soon, either destroying the narrative that the economy is strong and then data deteriorates, or that the reflation narrative broadens. And then we go a little bit more into the 2007 scenario. But either ways, the steepeners are there to cover both scenarios. So you're paying a bit of premium to get in macro volatility exposure, whether it's a broadening of the reflation, whether it's weakening of data. Basically, if you're looking for action, then you have steepeners on, and I'm looking for action. So 530 steepeners, mark me down. This year I've had a 75% hit rate on trades, which is way too high, which means I must be wrong somewhere. And this will be the trade where I'm wrong. It's at 15 basis points as we speak, 1.5 in the 530s in the US. For reference, this thing in 2007 went from 15 basis points, exactly the same point as today, to 100 basis points in a few months. So it can get quite explosive. Eh? And the carry you're paying is 2 basis points a month. So in principle, it can become explosive. Or I can be wrong. We'll see.
Hey, you know what? Good call on Dollar Brazil, because we've had a pretty low vol environment and the dollar's been selling off, but yeah, Dollar Brazil went from 495, I think, when you were set, you said to be bullish, it went to 508. It's come back off now, but that was a good call because there was a little mini positioning blow up there and it feels like it's over now, but that was a nice call on Dollar Brazil.
I told you, man, I've been way too, too high on the hit rate this year. I must be wrong somewhere. So I'm putting on a steepener. You guys can go ahead with the flattener and make money. Okay. That's the deal of the week. Now, what is the best thing that you read this week, Brent?
So it's a little bit wonky. We'll put the link in the show notes, but there's a really good piece by Stephanie Stancheva, a Brookings Institute piece, that talks about why inflation is so annoying to human beings and why it's so bad, even when, so an interesting phenomenon, I think if you asked, 5,000 Americans, is the price of gas high now compared to where it used to be? Most people would say, oh yeah, it's like gas is so expensive, groceries are so expensive. But then if you look at like where wages have come from since 2006 to now, and where gasoline prices have gone from 2006 to now, it's essentially a flat line. Like the number of hours to buy a gallon of gas hasn't changed in the last 20 years, basically. But I think people generally don't feel that way. So there's a disconnect. And the main reason she explains is that people think that their wages are lagging way more than they actually are, because people attribute rising wages to their own success of, I'm doing a great job and I switched jobs and I found this new great job, et cetera. Like I'm awesome at my job. So that's why I got a raise. But in reality, wages and inflation are kind of moving in lockstep, but people don't view it that way. And anyways, it's just a really interesting piece. And it kind of highlights exactly what's been going on the last couple of years, where the psychology of nominal versus real is very hard to untangle, because people feel nominal gains in prices, but then when their wages go up, even if they go up the exact same amount, they're still pissed about the prices that went up.
Very, very nice line of thought. I'd like to read the article. We'll put it in the show notes so that everybody can read that as well. The worst thing that happened to me, not that I read this week, but it happened to me. So for the Easter long weekend, I decided to take a trip to Austria. And I love Vienna, so we went there and we had a nice trip. But man, I mean, what's going on? Like, I can't enter a place and say, I'd like to have an espresso and please can I have a bit of water with it? and they literally threw the water in the espresso. I mean, what the hell are you doing? Like, okay, so there was a very Austrian thing or German or whatever, I don't know, but I felt very offended and I need to share it with you. When an Italian asks for espresso and water, it means espresso and on the side, a bit of water. It's used to cleanse your mouth before you drink the espresso, for fuck's sake, not throwing the water in the espresso. Jeez, man.
Maybe
Sorry.
You need to wear a little Italian flag the way that people wear Canadian flags on their backpacks so people don't think they're American when they're traveling in Europe.
I should do that. Okay, man. This has been fun as always. Anything else to add or shall we say goodbye?
No, I think that's it. Happy April to everybody.
Yep. Talk soon.
See you next week.
Ciao.
All right. Thanks, Alf.
Spectrum Markets is not affiliated with, promoting, or being compensated by the Macro Fund. Spectrum Markets does not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, service, or organization mentioned in this podcast.
The content provided on the Macro Trading Floor podcast is for general information purposes only. No information or other content provided in this podcast should be considered as investment advice. Seek independent professional consultation in the form of legal, financial, and fiscal advice before making any investment decision. Always perform your own due diligence.